was that the client was playing fast and loose with you, and that he might give us an order, and he in 50,000 shares, and he might give Messel an order and Kasnev an order or something, and so we, in our own right, would be totally innocent, but the jobber would actually suddenly see three or four of, you know, almost certainly the same seller coming in through different brokers, which is, from his point of view, a disaster. But we would, might have no control over it. In fact, I always used to think that it was the salesman was being wet if he couldn't talk to his client and say, look, you do realize that you don't sell it around the corner. Well, you know, you give us the order, or as much as you want done, and then, you know, if you're going to give some more to someone else, you let us finish ours first, and then go off elsewhere, not do it at the same time.
What was the main attraction to the client? Was it simply they could get a better price?
They might get a better price. They would certainly get rid of their stock. I mean, if they gave four people 25,000 shares to sell each, they would, within the 20 minutes or however long it takes to go in and deal and report back, will have got rid of 100,000 shares. The price mightn't be very good, but they would have got rid of them. Whereas if they came to us or any other broker and say, right, we want to sell 100,000, and you go to the market and they say, well, we'll take 25 to start, but we're not interested in taking any more, because for whatever reason we got too many or whatever. You know, he sold his 25 and he's still got 75 and he's looking at them.
Was it fairly difficult for a jobber to identify the institution that was involved in doing that, or would ultimately...
I think it was difficult in the old days. Well, it didn't happen too much in the old days. But, I think one certainly got to know, I think both brokers and jobbers got to know the likely ones who were going to do it. There was mainly Spiv Merchant Bank, certain fringe performance funds who would do it. I think obviously now under the new system, those boys are finding it very much harder because, you know, the market making side know straight away that it's Charlie boy who behaves like that, and so he doesn't get much sympathy. No, originally I don't think that the jobbers did probably know who they were, but it wasn't such a factor then.
Were you conscious as the 60s progressed of the contraction in the number of jobbers? Was this a...
Yes, certainly. I mean, I can't remember how many jobbers there were when I started, but I think it was quite a large number. I think it was sort of 60 or 70. Yes. And, you know, it very quickly got down to 20. But, I mean, the ones who'd gone out were normally one or two men firms, and it was really just, you know, those two guys punting around on their own account and making a little bit of money or not. I mean, it wasn't what you might call serious business, I don't think. It was a club, and it was meet your friends, and, you know, if you can make a few bob on the way, that's fine. So, I mean, some of them weren't particularly doing a really useful job or necessary job. As it came down to 20 or 15, yes, one was aware of them, of people going out, but in the contrary to that was that the ones remaining, the Weds and the Aykroyds and people were getting bigger and bigger, either on their own account or by merging with people who wanted to go out or whatever. Yeah. And by them getting bigger, you weren't finding you were denied dealing in the amount of stock particularly that you were wanting to deal in. You know, the market was getting bigger, although there were fewer players in it. So it wasn't, to my way of thinking, it wasn't a particularly detrimental step.
So you didn't feel that, particularly as the you go through the 70s and you had the two very big jobbing firms emerge, this place pressure on brokers because there were a very limited number of firms ultimately that they could go and deal with, and in certain cases they might have you over a barrel. Or was that, is that a mischaracterization or an incorrect characterization?
Yeah, no, I don't think that really happened. I mean, yes, it was a factor, but you see, you always, Wedd and Aykroyd were the biggest, but that was mainly because of their gilt business. Or in my view, it was mainly due to their gilt business, where they had a monopoly, the two of them, and I think that it was relatively easy to make money in gilts in the 70s, which subsidized some of the equity side, and because they were making money when perhaps pure equity deal, people like Smith Brothers and Bisgood were all right, but not making very much. I mean, Wedd and Aykroyd were doing pretty well because of the gilts. But you always had Smith Brothers, who were always prepared to take you on. You had Bisgood, who were expanding sort of through the 70s. And I think if one, it was sort of sour grapes, if one was thinking, you know, the big two are, you know, sort of have got us over a barrel. I don't actually think that's right.
Would you have ever, you personally, ever liked to have had more jobbing firms to go and deal with, or at least to go and check with?
I didn't. In theory, it would have been nice. In practice, I think it would have made things much harder because you would have... I mean, I don't think it could have happened because I don't think there was enough business around to be profitable for, you know, more jobbers to be there. I mean, that's why they were all disappearing, all merging. But I think it would have caused terrific problems if one had, you know, in terms of rumps of rights issues and things, if you'd actually got six or eight fairly big jobbers who you had to get them all in to, you know, how many do you want and this sort of thing. I think it would have made the broker's job terribly difficult because we'd have ended up with, you know, no put-through business, probably, which, okay, might have been good for the market, but we'd have all, you know, instead of the jobbers going out, all the brokers would have gone out. You know, it was a contracting number of jobbers and brokers because there wasn't sufficient business around to... you know, for everybody to make a living. So I think it was going the right way. And I think when it ended up before Big Bang, and you did have 4/5 big players, you know, that wasn't too bad. And Aykroyd, Pynchon, Smith, Wedd, Bisgood, were all quite competitive in various markets.
Now, capital and profitability were one of the strains on jobbing system during the later period. The other one that is often referred to as the development of an international market, both in international securities but also in UK domestic securities in the form of ADRs and so on. What was... either your attitude or the firm's attitude to these developments. Did you begin to feel that single capacity and the obligation to deal through the stock exchange itself was placing a strain on one's business, and that one was there were pressures to deal outside, either an American house in London.
Yeah, I think that is correct. I think that the feeling was that we in London were the odd man out in the way of doing business in dual capacity, that with the advent of the Merrill Lynches and Shearsons and people coming over here and setting up offices, they were outside the stock exchange is rules. In fact, weren't allowed to join. How much business they were doing, I'm not absolutely convinced in my own mind, but there was no doubt that if they did get an order, they could cross it with our clients, make two commissions and a turn, or whatever however they wanted to share it, which was jolly attractive to the broking side and probably the jobbing side. And we were prohibited from doing it by being members of the stock exchange. And I think that that was certainly one of the driving forces why my firm, which I think was one of the sort of chief pushers of single capacity, because with not a great deal of business around, not making very much money, it seemed the obvious, if not the only way, that we could actually increase our profitability or whatever, our income. But having said that, that was looking at people coming into England. I mean, as regards England becoming international, we didn't have very much of that business. We went through, as lots of other people have done, having offices in Tokyo and Hong Kong and New York. I mean, Tokyo was always a washout because the Japanese would appear to anyone to deal with themselves. So it's a very high cost, expensive operation without seeming to us to get any reward. We weren't any good in America, particularly. And we felt there that, you know, if people, as London became more international minded, if the Prue wanted to buy an American stock, the chances were that they'd go to an American broker who should know as much, if not a lot more, than an English broker who'd be passing it on second hand. So we didn't think that there was a lot of that business around. Hong Kong was all right, but that was a slightly different sort of business. But in terms of getting international business into London, we couldn't actually see it being a great feature. But by getting the international firms in who could bypass the stock exchange, that was what really made us think that we ought to be allowed to do the same thing.
Did you feel it was possible to get a better price for a stock from an outside house, like an American stockbroker, Merrill Lynch, or whoever, than the jobbers? Was there, during the later stages of single capacity, a definite premium on going outside?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know the answer to that because we never did that. Dealing in a UK stock, yes. Sort of thing. Yeah, yes. With an American. No, we've never ever done it. So, but I would be very surprised if I'd be very surprised if you could get a better stock, a better price. A client going direct might, because he'd be able to negotiate his commission and turn and roll them into one and possibly get slightly less. But I don't think a broker wouldn't be allowed to deal with them anyway.
Mm. Was that happening, the clients beginning to go direct to the outside?
There was a lot of talk that it was happening. Mm. Whether it was, I don't know. But it was a fear that it was happening. Mm. And it might well have been. Certainly in sort of ADRs and things like that, people were dealing with direct with Americans.
What did you, did you ever suspect that jobbers themselves might be developing or have contacts with outside clients or outside broking houses? And again, with reference, to this later period, but also during the earlier stages of your career.
Yes. We knew that they had. I mean, in the early stages, there was a limited amount of client-jobber relationship. There was one investment client who I think everyone would know did most of his dealing himself, and then with jobbers, and then booked it through a broker, came to the brokers and said, you know, I bought these or sold these, book it to Wed or Aykroyd or whoever. That was, I think that was the only one dealer. There was obviously contact, a certain amount of contact in the early days between the jobber and the companies in which they dealt through AGMs, and obviously trying to find out what was going on during the course of the year, which was reasonable. I think that the real contact between jobbers and clients started probably in the mid to late 70s, possibly earlier than that, the early 70s, when there was quite a lot of the merchant bank dealers were, you know, meeting the jobbers. There were quite a lot of investment clients where, you know, you'd have three or four investment clients and a jobber might be there because they'd like to talk to them about the markets generally or whatever. And then as we got nearer the end of the 70s and early 80s, then I think that the jobbers were doing much more because they were getting their own research in their own firms, and they were, that was of interest to the investment clients, and so they were getting to know them. And also I'm sure they were looking ahead to something was going to have to give at some point, and it was almost certainly going to be dual capacity going down to single.
What did you feel about this? Did you think it was perfectly reasonable or somehow against the spirit of single capacity, as it were?
I'm not sure that it was, really. I mean, jobbing is all about information, whilst stockbreaking is, really. And you've got to get as good information as you possibly can. And you might get some quite good information from a client. You can't really expect it to be, any source to be debarred. I mean, it's up to the jobber to try, and, you know, he'll either be shown the door or he'll be invited in. It didn't matter when we were all single capacity, because the jobbers could have a marvellous relationship with a client, but the fact remained, he still had to book it through a broker, and the broker still got his commission.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. You mentioned that one institution was notorious for doing this. What would be the nature of the commission? Would it be would it be the ordinary commission that one would receive?
Yeah.
The particular brokers concerned, in a sense, weren't losing money.
No. It was this chap just liked doing it himself. He'd come down at about 11 o'clock in the morning to the stock exchange and would sort of have a couple of gin and tonics with the jobbers. they'd talk about it, and then he'd come around to one of our boxes and say, right, you know, would you book the sale of quarter of a million distillers to Wed or whatever?
So there was no commercial advantage either for the institution,
no,
for example?
No, the client presumably felt that he'd dealt at the right price, because he'd done it, so he couldn't be he wouldn't be worrying whether he was leg day ever or not. It suited the jobber because he actually dealt with Wed mainly the whole time, very occasionally elsewhere, but mainly Wed. So he was a captive client where they were going to get the business, and they were going to get it clean because no broker had tried to place it or give an early warning that there was an order around. And it didn't matter to the broker, really. I mean, I think people twitched a little bit about it, but it, I mean, I was very relaxed about it. You know, you've got a nice order given to you, and you could always, you know, probably arrange or negotiate with the jobber to try and do the other half of it if you felt there was a chance. It wasn't taking anything away from anyone.
Yes.
There was still a commission, there was still a turn.
Strictly speaking, could a client tell you which jobber to book a bargain to? Or was was this an area of sort of a grey area? How would the stock exchange feel about that?
I have a feeling it was against the rules. But I think that it actually, if a client rang up and said, I want to sell or buy XYZ and I want you to deal with Aykroyd, I think one would probably go and do it. Because I don't think that it's... I mean, if he says that he wants to deal with Aykroyd, one or two things will have happened. He's either already talked to Aykroyd and said that, you know, Hall will come in and want to buy some. Or he will say, I want to deal with Aykroyd because actually I was in a muddle the other day and they were very kind and they gave us some, you know, they took some stock which at the wrong price and I'd like to give them something back, in which case I think we as the broker would go in and say, when you want a deal, this is from Charlie Bloggs of XY Pension Fund saying thank you for being so friendly the other day, which I think is perfectly reasonable.
Did your clients often know which jobbers you'd done the bargain with?
Very seldom. I mean, one or two asked, but very, very seldom. And, you know, I don't know why they would want to know, but I mean, if they asked, we'd be quite happy to tell them.
Well, the reason I ask is because with that example you've just mentioned, the client said would tell you that, you know, Aykroyd had done you a good turn the other day. Would that be a case in which you'd mention?
That's normally when there's a query or some error has been gone through and it comes up two or three days later.
Yes.
And, you know, the jobber said, okay, well, hell, I'll take it. Then we would tell the client that so-and-so has been very kind and actually done it. And we'd like to try and give them something back, you know, if possible.
Now, when I asked you about spread agreements, you said this was one of the first things that caused relations between jobbers and brokers to become a little bit more fraught. Were there any other factors in that development, or have we covered them already?
I think that and the Rule 90 put-throughs, which were becoming much more frequent, and because they were becoming much more frequent, the jobbers were missing out perhaps on their business, and so they were wanting to get more of the action. But I mean, the put through thing has been, you know, it's been a running sore ever since, and I note now that they're still talking about possibly bringing it back even in the new world. I think otherwise, it was the price agreements and possibly, I think that those two mainly. I mean, one was going to say perhaps the job is sort of trying to become bigger, but I mean, that's what actually it was all about. I mean, they weren't going to survive if they didn't. We were trying to become bigger. You couldn't blame them for trying to do more business.
When you say more business, covering more markets or bigger bargains, or more turnover?
Trying to take more of the business from the brokers, you know, by stopping put-throughs or whatever. Otherwise I don't think they were. It worked very well.
Did you feel that, thinking perhaps of the five main firms towards the end, that each had its own distinctive character, or were they all more or less offering a similar kind of service and all more or less dealing in the same way? For example, someone's characterized Aykroyd to me as the thinking jobbers. Someone's characterized Smith to me as great traders turning over stock very quickly. Biscuit felt they had a specialty in immediately digesting a piece of company news and offering a price very, very quickly.
Yes, I'm not sure that I mean, they're all pretty good at digesting a bit of news. I mean, they had to get the price out pretty quick. I would have thought Bisgood were recognised for the USM market, where Winterflood undoubtedly, through good publicity, whether in fact he was any bigger than any of the others, I don't know, but his publicity was very good. I think he was the leader in the USM market. Smith, I would agree, were traders. I would sort of rather look upon Aykroyd as the gentleman. Where does the players? And Pynchon were a sort of enigma. I mean, they were very good in some things, but they didn't seem to sort of modernize. I mean, either themselves or internally, it seemed to funny, very, very much sort of partners and the rest sort of attitude. They hadn't really altered. I think basically they were all, commercial, very commercial. They were all keen to do the business. They were all keen to make money. I don't think there are any real characteristics. I mean, characters and all that sort of thing rather went out. At the end, we'd all almost become automatons anyway. I mean, it was just prior to looking at screens where, there wasn't much room for characters. We were all getting rather sort of hectic and hassled by the new world.
Were you aware of what was known as the Jobbers Committee?
Yes.
What was the attitude of a broker to this particular body? Because it didn't have any official standing in the stock exchange.
We hated it. It was another move on from price agreements and everything. As you rightly say, it had no recognition from the stock exchange. It was an unofficial body, but it was sometimes presented to brokers as, the Jobbers Committee have decided to do this, which was fine, but I mean, they had absolutely no right to decide that. And so one's almost automatic reaction was, well, okay, fine, we've decided that we're not going to do it. because it was wrong in principle, and it was wrong in every possible way. I mean, if they had come out into the open and made it sort of admitted that this was the Jobbers Committee and these people were on it, and actually, if we actually had a couple of brokers on it as well, then it might get a bit of standing. But I suppose it was actually trying to do what the council wasn't doing, really. But that was a great irritation when, you occasionally sort of dealer came in or one of your mates in another firm and said, have you heard the Jobbers Committee have decided to do this? And say, well, I haven't heard it, or I have heard it. And, absolutely monstrous. Sharp paying attention to that.
Did it make the system any less competitive, though?
I can't answer that. It did. I'm trying to think of sort of things that they actually suggested. I mean, one's feeling is that it was there to try and make things easier for the jobbers, was the only possible reason for it to exist. There were probably reasons for it. They're like these competitive fund managers who run around the back. I mean, that would actually be perfectly reasonable for the jobbers to form a little group and come around to the brokers who are either involved in it or who know the clients and say, look, isn't there something we could jointly do about it? I mean, that actually would seem reasonable, but to set up under their own steam just didn't seem to be the right idea. Mm. I think they were aware of the fact that it was a pretty unpopular idea.
Well, let me ask you a few concluding questions. What would you say, or would you say, there were strengths in single capacity, and what would you say they were?
I think there were. I think that you were able to deal much easier than you can now. I mean, in my view, there's no doubt that if you have to report a deal that you've done as you do under the current system, 90 minutes after you've dealt or whatever, that people aren't necessarily going to take you on in a large amount. If it's going to be announced to the world that the deal has been done, it's not very difficult to